Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron. That was Taisha Tari with Karanga. And in the studio, I've got Ngaranora Renata. Good morning.
Ata marie e te whānau whānui o Whaingaroa. Ka nui te mihi atu ki a koutou i tēnei rangi. Koira te mihi atu ki a koutou.
Kia ora. So today, what are we doing today?
Today, I firstly like to acknowledge the passing of the dog man, as I heard that he's known, although I knew him as Brian.
Yeah.
Brian and Luga.
Luga is the dog.
Yes, Luga is the dog. Luga is one of many dogs that were cared for, came under Brian's care. My understanding is it was through the local vet that occurred. There was a time in Brian's life, so I learnt yesterday, when they held the farewell for him across the road at the club.
Yeah.
And many of his whānau were there. His auntie I met, she's in her 90s, Thelma. So they were very connected here, and they still are, of course. But Brian had become over time...
Well, he was
disenchanted with the world.
Maybe I didn't know him. I know he was homeless for a while, but the community did a fundraiser and bought him a van.
Actually, I'd like to speak into that space about homelessness, because that's an American word that has come into our consciousness through community development. I'm not sure I'm cool with that, and the reason I say that is because people are whenua-less. So since the treaty was signed, there's always been a partner of the treaty, if you think of it like a marriage, that have been pretty much without their land. So is that landless? Is that homeless? Is that how we see it? No. Tangata whenua have never been brought into that framework that America has been suffering from for quite a long time, around homeless people in their very large cities, or all over, from my understanding. And there's in those cities, you know, they're literally thrown out, or unaffordable conditions have made it possible for them to live on the streets. In some shape or form, you know. India, the same. There's many people who live in India in tunnels. It's thousands of people, thousands. So does that apply here? Or really, if we look back in it and take a much more sobering look at our relationship, have we actually got mana whenua who actually live without their lands? And that's pretty serious.
Well, sometimes I know Māori people who... locally, who they've their rental property has gone to someone else, and they've had to move out. And some of them have been able to move back to, they say, family land or tribal land, which is not an option I would have. I could probably go back to family, but there wouldn't be a particular place.
Yeah, well, that's a mythology too. Tribal lands are actually just diminished. And when they speak of tribal lands, they're pretty much speaking about a lamppost. You know, there's nothing. It's not. It actually has a much smaller, very small.
What you're saying, yeah.
By comparison, what we were used to thriving in, and you know, let's be real about what we're looking at. You know, Māori people are not thriving. We are not thriving in our own land. Mm-hmm. So is that whenua-less? Yes, it is. You know, I have no questions to around that. And so I think with Brian, he was actually, we could, as culturally, under that, through those lenses, it wasn't difficult for us to see that he was without material wealth, and that he was definitely not... He didn't retreat into a state of you couldn't find him. He was actually very sociable.
And he was very visible.
Very
you always
visible,
see him and his dog. Yeah.
Always around. So, you know, what does that tell you about the personality of this beautiful human being that I had encounters with? And his It was quite sorrowful, really, because he was also part of the storyline around the Vietnam War, and it became quite a historical point of reference for him.
And that's why he was there. The service was at the club. And the flags at half mast, because of the club has the connection with RSA. The RSA is kind of based there. If it's based anywhere in town, it's based
there.
Right.
Well, so the Vietnam War is nothing to be proud of, you know, with Agent Orange and our part to play within that chemical warfare. With
the whole thing is not good. Yeah.
And so the mental trauma and the dogs in his life, the Mokai, we would call them Mokai.
Meaning
that it's a pet, and it's usually a dog. It's in reference to a dog. A Mokai is a pet. But in Te Ao Māori, the relationship between a dog and a human being is almost closer than two humans.
We're very,
the devotion, the dedication to each other's life, the way that unfolds, and Matua Brian had that. He had that with the dog that he had, Luga. He was never going to outlive Luga. He was going to die because he would not have lived another day. He didn't have that capacity in his physical, mental strength. He was very sorrowful. That's my take on it. I'm just saying that his relationship with Luga, and yes, we saw the family who have able to care for Luga. They were there, you know, and Luga's life will maybe hopefully bring a lot of joy to the family, and it will be an exchange. He'll be more joyful.
Yeah. Maybe Brian felt like he had a place. I mean, the community raised money for a van for him to live in.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe he felt like he did have a place, you know, even if he was.
And it was a really nice van, actually.
Whatever we say, whatever terms we use, homeless or landless, whenua-less, it would have been clear to him that he had a place here.
And that he was loved.
Yeah.
He was loved. But, you know, when you... the stories I heard from Rangi, you know, Kiriopa, like he lived at Whale Bay. Don't we all want to live at Whale Bay? And then he moved from there with a caravan that he was gifted by the Kiriopa whānau. Oh, no, sorry, he lived at Manu Bay first.
Yeah.
And then he was gifted a caravan by the Kiriopa whānau, by Rangi. He went to live at Whale Bay. Don't we want to live there too?
Well, you and I can't afford to, I don't think, anymore.
But Brian did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, it kind of worked out.
And then Ōkete, of course. Ōkete was his final home out.
Right.
I mean, those are such gorgeous places. Like, hello.
Yeah, well, maybe this was... Yeah. Yeah, if your house is small enough to move and you can move it around, maybe you can choose to live in those places.
Yes. So I smile to myself and I think, well, you lived pretty much in paradise and were taken in by this community in a very genuine way, and I mihi to that history that we have now. For those of you who don't know that Brian has passed away and that Luga has a new life with another whānau, and the vets were very involved in Luga's care as well over the years.
Yeah. Well, I remember Brian used to have a different dog. And then the dog died a few years ago, and it was also an Alsatian, and so.
Oh yeah, they were always Alsatians. Apparently, he fell in love with Alsatians when he was younger. Mm. He won a dog in a raffle.
Oh really? That's how it started.
That's how it started. His love of dogs. How gorgeous is that, to win a puppy in a raffle?
Yeah. That's funny. We should try that here for something. Maybe not yet.
Oh, sorry, I'm just smiling because it's such a beautiful story that unfolded when I was over at the club yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And heard about he was called by his mates in the army, Handsome. That was his name.
Oh, really? Because he was handsome?
Oh, really? What do you mean by
that? I don't know. I don't know what he looked like when he was younger. I was just wondering, was he handsome or was he particularly...
What do you mean, was it behind his beard, was he handsome? He had sparkly eyes, I thought.
Oh, okay, there we go. All right, that's the clue. So you also wanted to talk about care of animals, and this kind of talking about Brian's dog Luger is probably a good way into that.
Yes, I'm particularly interested in the way veterinary science approaches it, or in terms of herbal medicine and homeopathy and those other sciences that we call complementary mainstream.
Before we get into it, we should say what your background is. and because healthcare, well, how do you describe? I don't want to use. I'm going to get the words wrong if I try to describe
it. My best pharmacy is the forest.
Yeah,
it's one I'm very familiar with. So put me in the middle of not a jungle. No, I can't handle that. But a forest.
Yeah,
the Ngahere, I'd probably live very well. Yeah, live well into my 90s. If you left me there.
So the herbal medicines.
Herbal medicines is my background.
Yep.
I've done not only formal study, but informal study in those fields by some masters of that field who were herbal, worked with herbs mainly non-native, mainly.
Yeah.
And then the native trees, of course, spoke to me. Through my own people, and as life had journeyed along, I picked up many other skills within that field, that holistic field, through Miri Miri. I held a clinic for many years with Miri Miri and hot stone therapy, and making medicine is really a very important part of my practice, based on natural rhythms of harvesting and how they're dried. Drying is an art of the heart once you harvest, and how then the preparation. So the medicine wasn't really presented to me on the shelf in a pharmacy, and yeah. I had to go, I don't know who made this. I am the maker. I chose to become the maker developer, if that's a word that we can use. I nourished that part of my professional development and became quite a specialist. I am a specialist in that clinical practice around when you make rungoa in a home setting, appropriate times, and why it's a ceremonial way of preparation. So you don't, you know, you're not eating, you're not chatting, you're not drinking wine or anything like that. You're not enjoying yourself in that way, but you're enjoying yourself in another way. Those don't resonate together. So really all those social part of working with the medicine in your home kitchen, say, or if you haven't got a clinical situation where you have access to the, what do they call it, the kitchen, that's for that purpose.
So this has raised an interesting question for me, because you used the word complementary medicine before, with hand quotes, but we don't have I don't see a lot of complementary medicine for our pets and our animals out there.
Yeah, and that's...
And I'd never thought of that even.
Oh, no, I had a very, very... I felt a very healthy conversation with someone who's right in the field, who lives in... can't remember now. But it was
not here.
I know he's very connected to all the vets.
Okay.
He actually looks after all the different vets in a particular area, quite a lot of them, and their practice. And yes, we talked about herbal medicine, and he said he actually acknowledged. He said, "I'm actually open to this discussion." He said, "Well, you know, it does make sense to me that if you have that science available to you around using herbal medicine," and in Europe it was Anna de Blaquet. I'm just trying to think of her first name, but she was a gypsy woman. She wrote extensively about herbal medicine for animals.
Yeah,
and there are films you can watch, documentaries about the science that she developed. She was highly regarded for her medicinal herbal medicinal knowledge and her preparation homeopathically too, of medicines for dogs and other animals, goats. All her animals were stunningly beautiful and healthy in these documentaries that I watched.
Okay.
Juliet de Blacklevert, and she very passionate about herbal remedies and medicines, not just when they're sick and not when they've just had an incident, you know, in their on the farm or where they're living, but for their well-being, their continued well-being. So we currently, of course, as you know, pay an extraordinary amount of money. We almost go, like, oh, I've got to go to the vet, and it's like, oh my gosh, but we do it, and then and the bill really is that we receive is quite out of kilter in my mind with the costs that we would for our own well-being. We don't pay anything like that. Well, you know, our healthcare system as humans is
subsidized. Yeah.
And I would love to see that happen for us if there was herbal medicine available on the shelves of our vet clinics for our animals, because it's...
So do you treat your own pets? Do you have pets and you treat your own pets?
Yes, I do. I do. I make up the medicine for Ted. Unless
Ted is a cat?
Ted is a fox terrier.
A fox terrier. Right, okay.
Yeah. I'm very comfortable with that also, which is, Andy says, oh, can you? And I go, yep, I'll get on to that. And I make up a brew. The medicine woman makes up her brew from what's available in her pharmacy, her natural pharmacy of plants.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Ted then licks it all off. I go, oh, well, he's going to get it internally now. So if it's in the form of a balm.
Right, okay, yeah. The dogs will eat anything.
Yeah.
It would seem.
I've seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, are there people in our community who will treat animals with complementary medicine?
No, but we did have a very big, and what I call encounter as a whānau, with a cat that was within our family circle. And we decided to offer a homeopathic, a very good homeopath, who we knew had that science, who had that knowledge, that mātauranga, and that particular cat became very well. But having said that, during that period of caring for this cat, this cat, during the time she was unwell, she had a broken leg, and the vet wanted to put her down, and we disagreed as a whānau. So we decided to follow this path of engaging the services of a very knowledgeable homeopath in Hamilton, and it worked. We were very confident that it was even the SPCA came out and said, you know, we've been contacted by the vet and, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. And so we hid. We went into hiding.
For a cat? We've seen these national news stories.
did you feel that? He said, for a cat!
Well, like, do you remember these national news stories where a family has got a child that's got cancer and they want to do an alternative treatment and the medical system goes nuts and there's a manhunt for the family and they're in hiding? And it seems slightly preposterous that would happen over a cat. I guess it wasn't that big, you know, it wasn't national media.
No, we could have, though.
But the fact that an institution was chasing you, was the concern that a cat with a broken leg just can't, the leg can't set properly because the cat's too mobile?
Has had babies and is doing very well.
But I'm trying to work out why that they said it had to be put down.
Is control. In my mind, it's control. Over
what were they saying, though? Were they saying that the leg, a cat is too, moves around too much in it, and the bone won't set?
Yes.
Okay.
And so we, in our wisdom, took on that kōrero and followed through. And yes, cat's thriving. It's had beautiful kittens. She.
And I agree with you, the control is part of the story. I just wanted to hear what the rationale was.
I think we were really challenging something, you know, that it's like, I know, I can see what's happening. You know, this is not possible to mend. You need to consider putting down this cat. And we disagreed. We disagreed heavily, and we proved ourselves to be, not them to be wrong, that's not how we see it. We proved that herbal medicine, through the right person, through homeopathy, classical homeopathy, which is a beautiful field, of and it's not alternative and it's not complementary. It should be mainstream. Has science that is very thorough to fall back on. You know, its backboard is extraordinary science behind the preparation of homeopathic medicine.
So can I ask about the, because the bone still needs presumably time to set. I'm kind of curious how the healing went in that regard.
The cat's name is Sapphire, by the way. And yeah, we have the her sister, Ahi. Ahi's thriving in Pukete, lives in Pukete.
Right, so how did...
So it was
which
reset.
I'm just wondering about the mechanics of resetting Sapphire's leg.
It wasn't like, oh yeah, we just gave her drops and things. There was a period of time when our friend, I'm not going to say who that was, but maybe you go, oh, Sapphire.
Right.
The bone was reset through homeopathic medicine, and Sapphire was to be really still. And so she cared for Sapphire over those weeks.
So it took a person kind of full time.
Took a person with extraordinary manaakitanga to understand that what is proposed as not being possible with the aroha of a human involvement from this wahine, it can take that, eh? It can take that commitment.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, commitment, and in our modern world of everything being done real quick.
That's the problem I with the medicines.
They couldn't imagine, the vet couldn't imagine a way that would work, which is kind of understandable in this world.
I think they do have a something there that says there must be more, there must be. But, you know, what's available there within that industry is comes from, you know, drug companies producing these synthetic drugs. They're synthetic. And when you say herbal, it's almost like, oh. And
I You're go, one of those.
Always will be.
Always will.
I will retreat to the ngahere if there's any left, whether it's second generation or third generation ngahere, which is the forest. I will retreat to it someday at some point and go, just leave me alone. That's my pharmacy. Always will be. I totally trust the forest and the sea, the moana, to have the medicine that we need.
That's an interesting story. And I think back to the time when a particular child was taken into hiding. And I think you hear about all this through the media, just the national media. So you don't really get you get the establishment point of view, but even with that, a lot of people were quite surprised at how heavy-handed the medical hierarchy was. Not the day-to-day people you meet in the healthcare system, but the medical hierarchy was kind of like defending its turf.
That's a very good way of putting it. You know, we felt that, and we're still on our turf.
Yeah, and so even normal people who are very happy with the conventional medical system were kind of like opening their eyes wide, going, "What? You know, this is quite. They're getting pretty heavy here.
Quite bullying. Yeah. We were bullied. I'll say that because it was very extraordinary, actually, that they said, "No, this cat must be Sapphire must be put down. Sapphire." I must put a photo on the Raglan notice board, and you go, oh.
It must be put down for its own good.
She's thriving. her babies are in other people's homes now.
I mean, if they had their own way of caring for and helping the cat to get better, you could understand the argument. But their way was to put the cat down for its, so it didn't suffer, I guess, is what they were saying. But still, yeah, okay, all right.
And we disagreed.
These things happen in this world.
Yeah, we not only disagreed, we actually had a backup plan. And we moved so quickly, you know, because I was contacted and I went, yes, I know what pathway we can go down. You know, I wasn't messing around. I wasn't like, oh, maybe there's a medicine out there that can, you know, we don't have to
right, yeah,
consider.
You knew what you were going to do.
No, I knew. If I didn't know, then I would say, look, I don't know and I really can't assist in this way. No, I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a self-belief in the people that you know in the field. And I, you know, there's a range of people in this complementary field who are outstanding masters in their understanding of medicine.
And when I expressed surprise at a cat, all this fuss over a cat, it wasn't that the people who owned the cat or cared for the cat wanted to keep it alive. That makes sense. It was that they got in touch with the SPCA and they were trying to
pressurize
people, and that, yeah. Because
that's what happened.
Because it had to be put down. That's
It's a sad story.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I wasn't there at the time, but it does sound.
But we went into hiding,
crazy.
Yeah.
I'm laughing at the absurdity, because it's.
I think we wanted to also show our manaakitanga and that we had a great source of strength that we could rely on to change that story. And that's part of the strength of the human family as we go, when we're right down there, you know, traumatized by life and life stories and our own story, that we can dig so deep that we can say, actually, I can change the story. I can transform this negativity and I can turn poison into medicine. And I love that. I love to do that. Like poison as in not just something you eat and take, but a situation where it's just dark and, well, not just dark, it's, you know, trauma. I go, give it to me to change it in the medicine and the healing to possible hope through a number of ways, not only herbal medicine, you know, karakia. There's a beautiful path to know a simple invocation lifts the spirits. Yeah, it's a really important part of who I am to have that in my kite of mātauranga, to have those tools, those beautiful tools.
Yeah.
I keep them sharpened.
And if people are particularly interested in the story, I just want to point out that we haven't named anybody except Sapphire the cat.
Sapphire.
All other participants shall remain anonymous.
They absolutely will.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the best way. Okay, well, that's a very interesting story. Let's move on to just have a quick chat about your te reo classes. You've got some more coming up for the new term.
I do, and I guess I'm supposed to be recruiting, I think it's called. So I have a kura reo, which is on Monday morning. Both classes are at the Old School Art Centre. The morning class, they will start at the first week of the school term, the fourth, and run for 8 weeks.
So that's 2 weeks from today. Yeah. What day? Monday, you said?
Monday.
2 weeks from yesterday.
Yeah. 2 weeks. And then the kura pō, which is the evening class, will be on the Tuesday evening in Eva's, the whare or Tua Iwa Rickard. I love that room. It's looked after me. That room. That's the room in.
The one on the left when you come in
the
front door.
That's it. The one on the left. I like to have my classes in there. If you put me somewhere else, I go, no thanks, nope, I'm staying here. Well, only because, you know, it's the naming of the room is a beautiful reminder of who she was, who she is, and how
she. Well, she was instrumental in making sure that the old school survived, because that building was Have you seen the photo on the wall in there? The building in, the, I don't know, was it the 60s or something, when it was, that was the council depot, and the building was just becoming derelict, and I think the council at the time thought it's not worth saving this building. But Eva could see a purpose for it, and since then, you know, she got it going, and then the community has run with it, and the building. And now, not only has the building survived and in beautiful condition, they've had to build more buildings.
Yes.
Because there's so much activity happening there.
It's thriving.
So her vision was spectacularly on the target.
Ai, kia ora mō tēnā.
Yeah.
It's really important to remember who are those paramount seeds in our community, and have that thinking, that whakaaro of knowing much beyond to a time when mokopuna, the grandchildren. I'd like to just speak briefly about that kupu, moko puna.
Yeah.
So in Te Ao Māori, the moko is to where the DNA of your family whakapapa as in a moko.
Yeah.
And moko is like, an external expression.
Yeah.
Of moko. However, the DNA is transferred directly to the grandchild. So you miss out the parents, they don't matter. But the moko, I didn't mean it that way. You don't miss them out, they're pivotal to the birth of
they're quite important.
into this moko, but the relationship of the mokopuna, moko and the puna, the spring, who is a spring of source of great well-being, is the relationship of a grandparent to their grandchild is very close.
Mm.
So that word embodies that understanding. They're the blueprint. So, you know, they can do no wrong. The grandchildren.
Yeah.
Like, they can do no wrong and they can have whatever they like. They're my mokos.
This pattern is pretty universal in my family. I was like, my parents were not as strict with the grandchildren as they were with me.
Right? That is to be so, and that is
very noticeable.
That's the beautiful story, you know, like about the mokopuna. Like, they come and they look at you and you go, you can have anything you want, moko. You don't have to say it. You just look at them and they go, ah, kia ora. So that's what mokopuna means. It's that DNA that's, mirroring. You see your moko and you go, oh, you're just a mirror of me. So you can have whatever you like. You want lollies? Okay. Yeah. Not allowed. Mummy said,
yeah.
Mum, I'm a vegan. Oh, are you? Oh, well, today you're not. When you're with me, you're not.
Yeah. The parents are like, ah.
Mum will spoil them and, oh, my gosh, they'll come home and they'll want more. Go, yeah, we'll give them more.
So your classes...
Back to my classes.
Back to your classes. So,
I'll talk
Monday.
About those kupu, you know. I'll talk about the richness of what those te reo, what it embodies within the language, because they have beautiful offerings, you know. When you look at the meaning of kupu, and so we can go on that journey and look at our reo. But my focus will be predominantly on spoken. Your spoken reo, you know.
Yeah. And so this is this for beginners, intermediate, what sort of if you know nothing, is it okay?
If you know nothing, haere mai. If you know something, haere mai.
Yeah.
So my rhythm would be I would contact you before the classes start, get an understanding of where you are sitting within the te reo journey.
Yeah.
And with my expertise, because my background is in, I've taught in many schools, many settings, from bilingual to kura kaupapa Māori, mainstream. My first experience was in mainstream. I was at Hamilton East School for 5 years in that way. And so what I can do is navigate something that I feel would enrich where you are right at this point in time. So have no fear. Come along and... engage in these two offerings. They're not long. They're probably not what I would really love to be doing in terms of reo development, but for now they're something that you can feed from within your busy lives. Mm. Everyone's too busy, including me.
So, and how do people book in?
Well, we do have an administrator.
Andy. Is that what you refer to, Andy as? As the administrator.
Of course, because he wanted to be. So I'm very grateful for that. Mm. There's a email address, really. That's how he prefers to take the enrolment process. And then, yes, that's how it works.
Shall we read that out? Do you want me to read that out?
Yes, please.
FellsAnthony@gmail.com. So Andy Fells. Name backwards and longer, Fells Anthony, FellsAnthony@gmail.com. And if you forget all that, you're going to keep leave this poster with me,
yeah.
So I can get in touch, okay, with the radio station or probably the old school as well. Can probably put people in touch, so
yes.
But we like
good.
To have the poster to go with our other posters of events happening,
yeah. It's extraordinary, Andy. I love it,
yeah.
Yes, no, I very much would like to hear from you.
And can I ask, how did you and your daughters had the word gig is kind of somehow not quite right, but an event at the Yard?
Oh, look,
Friday night a week ago or 2 weeks
so
ago.
So humbled by our community, yeah.
So this is with Taonga Pūro.
Yes, absolutely.
Traditional Māori instruments.
Yes. We all we offered to our community first, hapuri, because that's, you know, was important, and being at the Yard was just beautiful. Mm. To have Naomi and Brian's total support for what we were doing, and yeah, the community came out and it was very warm in there, and we're very encouraged by the sound system. I don't remember his name, sorry, but yeah, it was beautiful. That was really important.
Probably Joel. Was Joel on the sound?
Yeah. The sound we were
very, young guy.
Yeah, because of our instruments, the type of instruments we were using. And we then rolled into it, really, and it flowed. We understood what we were wanting to do, which that helps, doesn't it? We didn't wing it at all. And that was the key.
Yeah.
That we were coming at it from a very professional point of view, but introducing probably to many more depth around Taonga Pūro, that journey will continue.
Yeah.
For us.
So there'll be more, you're saying there'll be more performances?
Yes, ceremonial performances. Yeah, we're not them and us, it's, you know, you're the audience, but more, yes, it's a different approach, and I think that's where the magic will happen in terms of the way that we navigate Taonga Pūro in all of the communities we engage with. We've got a workshop coming up next Saturday at Aratiatia, but that's by invite.
Okay. All right. Well, when you do have another one in town, we will we'll talk about that on the show. And I'm going to play a song now. This is by Ia. It's a New Zealand Aotearoa band. And the word is, it looks like me in English, M-E. Can you give us a really accurate pronunciation?
Mea. Me.
Just M-E. Just
me.
Just me.
Me.
It's the subtleties. I'm interested in the subtleties of it because it's obvious that R, A, E, or U, they're going to say air, but
me.
Me. Yeah. But Māori speak with more, when you speak it properly, you speak with more energy, more emphasis than the way, especially the way I speak English, which is very casual and tending toward mumbling. So that's the. Sometimes I think that's
Aroha, my whanau, but yeah, it does sound like a mumble. Not you specifically, but sometimes I go, "What did they just say?"
yeah. Oh, this the story of old people listening to young people, older people listening to young people. I have that as well. Anyway, here is Ia with me, and we've been talking to Ngaronoa Renata with our Kairongoa segment. Thank you for coming in.
Ai, kia hau maru, ka kite anō.